session number 20457, Real 8.
Brigadier Randall, Real 8. Do you have any idea of roughly how many days marching it took you to get from Shillong to your destination in the Empire?
Well, as I said earlier, halfway through I developed jaundice and went off, but my recollection is it took something in the order of about a month, because we had to move by night route most of the time, certainly down from Shillong down to Guwahati, and then along to Dimapur. I think then we were loaded into trucks for the long journey from Dimapur up to Kohima and down to Imphal. The road south of Imphal was only three tonnerable, I think, for about 40 or 50 miles. Certainly the last part up the famous chocolate staircase was jeep treks only, and I think it was done by, again, by night march route. But I'm slightly vague because I wasn't there. I think about a month. I mean, it was a fortnight I was on the move, and we were only about halfway round.
Were you there for the movement in trucks at all, or were you sick for that time?
For a big one?
When they were moving in trucks, were you there for that?
Oh, yes. Well, not at that time, but I had been when we moved from Ranchi to Imphal. In one's memory now, we moved up to Imphal twice.
Yes.
And I'm a bit hazy about... Mm. I mean, it was pretty much the same drill, but I can't remember which was which.
When you were moving in motor transport, were you in any particular formation on the road?
No, we weren't moving tactically at all.
You weren't?
No, because the Japanese then were way to the... They were... they were still on the east bank of the Chinwin, and they were right down south of Fort White, so that it was very much a sort of rear area move. So there was no question of tactical moving, apart from air sentries and keeping an eye out for air attacks, which didn't materialise, thank God.
What sort of speed could you make on those roads in your three-tonners, where they were capable of taking a three-tonner?
Well, as we were moving in the dry weather, and so in those convoys, I think they seemed to move at about sort of 15 to 20 miles an hour, not much more, because it was a narrow, winding road. Certainly, I wouldn't have thought much more.
Well, it's an awful lot faster than walking.
Oh, yes, and far less tiring. Oh, yes. And the only trouble was, of course, the laborious business of loading animals into three-tonners. And then you can't... You know, you move up, and then they've obviously got to be taken out at night and fed and watered and... Then you've got to clean out, I mean, all the sort of dung and stuff in the truck. So that it's a long and tiring business. And therefore, I seem to recall that one finished by about 3 o'clock in the... I mean, you aim to get to wherever you were staging the night about 3 o'clock in order to get all this administration done.
What time would you set off in the morning?
Well, we got off pretty early. I think we got away about 8. But then there was some sort of... I seem to remember there was some sort of... Certainly on some stages of that Dimapur-Kohima road, there was road controls, I think. And I'm sure at one stage, because I did it several times, I can't remember which one, but certainly there was an up convoy and a down over certain stretches. Therefore, sometimes you went off quite early. And another time we seemed to... You waited till about 10 o'clock. I'm a bit vague, but there had to be some sort of control because the road was too narrow for two-way traffic.
How did you actually control the convoy when it was in movement? Did you have a military police attached to you, or was it a regimental police function?
I don't think the military police were involved. But obviously, there was a checkpoint somewhere just north of Dimapur, just south of Dimapur, to control the convoys, and there was a sort of vehicle harbouring area there. But on the move, you didn't. I mean, there was only the one road. We didn't have any radio communication, so I'm not quite sure what would have happened if. You see, we were moving in second line transport. This wasn't our own, it was RASC transport. And I'm pretty sure from memory that they had a breakdown vehicle and mechanics to deal with any vehicle that broke down. I think it was led by the company commander of the leading vehicle group.
And he would have been an RASC man, wouldn't he?
Well, yes, that's right.
Did you have regular halts on motor movement?
Oh, yes, we did. Well, I mean, really, for the soldiers to relieve themselves. But then, you see, half the battalion was in Land Rovers, and they went quite separately. So only half the battalion was on a mule, it was on a horse basis, so that we weren't moving tactically at all. I seem to think that the A company and B company went off quite separately in their Land Rovers.
Did they go off ahead of the main body?
Yes. And we met up with them, I think, in Imphal. So it was very much a non-tactical move.
When you came back after your sickness, how did you get back to the unit? What was your method of transport?
Well, I got to Dimapur. I just used my initiative. I want to get back to battalion. The fact is that anybody with any experience of Burma tried to avoid movement control because they always messed you about. And therefore, if you were an officer with any gumption, you could always find some friendly unit to give you a bed for the night or give you a meal. That wasn't a problem. And you just use your gumption to find somebody who's going up to get a most comfortable ride. And then I got to Imphal. There was some sort of rest camp there. And again, I just used my initiative. Found there was somebody going down from Imphal. I spent the night there. Going down to Tidim. I spent the night somewhere at Tidim in a small rest camp run by the military police. But I mean, had I been coming the other way, there might have been a few. If I'd been going out of the battle, questions might have been asked. But I mean, as an officer trying to get back to his unit, everybody was helpful, really.
In effect, you were a military hitchhiker.
Absolutely. That's a very apt description. Yes. Yes.
Had the battle already
started? I had my Batman with me.
You had your Batman with you? Mm.
You see, the Indian Army officers always took their Batman on leave, and we've got a warrant and all the rest of it. So I had my Batman with me, so that the sort of things like my bedding rail and those sort of things, that he looked after my baggage and that sort of thing, and I looked after him from the point of view of getting him a food and bed.
You said the battle area. Had the fighting started when you were on your way back?
No.
What happened after you got to Tidim? Did you go on
Well, the battalion was ordered to leave the horses behind. I can't remember the milestone, but somewhere about milestone 50 on the Imphal Tidim Road.
Would that be 50 miles from Imphal?
50 miles from Imphal. I think. And the battalion, the battalion was deployed on the very right-hand flank of the division, facing south, with the Bhimapur River as our right boundary. When I say deployed, we had one company, or 2 or 3 miles away to the south, on a feature called Point 6052, just south of a village called Mulbem, and then we had another company, the other only other company up there, at a place called Vankti. We were not in, the division was not in contact with the Japanese then. The rest of the division was to our left and east, really based on Kennedy Peak. We had very unusually one section of 25 pounders of 129 Field Regiment, a splendid lowland territorial regiment, only because this Point 6052 was out of range of the divisional artillery, which was based on Kennedy Peak, and of course way out of range of battalion mortars. And it was just as well we did have that section, but and we patrolled down to the Manipur River. There was nothing extraordinary thing. There didn't seem to be any sort of patrolling west of the Manipur River. They seemed to think that the Japanese would not come that way. In fact, they didn't come that way. I believe the Lushai scouts or someone was supposed to be there, but we never saw them. It was December, January. It was really quite cold. We were up at 5,000 or 6,000 feet. One marvellous weather. And it was really rather pleasant.
What was the ground like down towards?
Well, the ground, we were on this ridge, which dropped away, not entirely sheer, but you could see two or three, couple of thousand feet below the Manipur River. And at night, when it was still, you could hear the waters. It was a very romantic sort of place. It was not unlike Scotland. It was open sort of scrub. And then it went down to Mulbem. You went down about 2,000 feet to this place, Mulbem, and then you had to go up another 2,000 feet up to this A Company position on Point 6052. On our left, that is to the east, was a huge feature called Cwm Vwm, which was an outcrop of Kennedy Peak. But it was very hilly, very hilly. Well, you'd call it, in this country, you'd call it mountains, but in Asia, it was very hilly, rolling, beautiful, lovely scenery, and most attractive.
Was the river a serious obstacle, the Manipur River?
No.
Could you have waded it?
You could, and we did. At that time of the year, you see, it was a dry season. I don't think we would have done that in the monsoon.
Could you have driven a vehicle across it or through it?
You could if you could have got to it. There was no track. I don't recall any track leading down to the river. Certainly wasn't an obstacle for infantry.
You mentioned the village Mulbem. Was it inhabited?
Yes, there was. It was occupied by Chins. Being in the Chin Hills, the village were occupied by Chins. We were in the northern part of the Chin Hills, where they appeared to be. Well, they were at that time seemed to be on our side. We had one amusing incident when there was a big meeting at they used our battalion as the rendezvous, and they brought this very important Chin chieftain in, they wanted him to throw in his lot with the British, and he came along, all sorts of political agents and important people, and then he decided he wanted to have a crab. And so he went along, and for the first time in his life, he sat on our mess Thunderbox. And he was so delighted with this, he said that he wanted to spend the rest of the day there. And it was so important to keep him happy. But there were, I was the adjutant, and there were impatient officers saying, what the hell's that chap doing there? I want to have a crap. And everyone would say, well, sorry, go out in the bushes. No, he's allowed to sit there all day. And indeed he did, and he sort of held court sitting there. I like to think that after the war, for his services, the British government would have presented him with a Thunderbox, but I don't suppose it happened.
Did he decide to give full cooperation?
Yes, he did. It was successful. We all put it down to the pleasures of sitting on our mess Thunderbox. Sorry, rather frivolous interjection, but...
Not at all frivolous.
But I mean...
It's a new and interesting area of diplomatic practice.
Well, I put it... I've often thought to write a memo to the Foreign Office about less subtle forms of diplomacy in wild areas.
Well, I'm sure that Mr. Carlton Brown of the FA would be delighted to... What did the village consist of? And what sort of size was it? Do you have a recollection of that?
There were huts, bamboo huts. I think they're like most villages in Burma. They were up, raised up because of, even though it was on the side, it was a sort of, on the edge of this sort of hill. It was bamboo, certainly made of bamboo, unlike what we've been seeing in Manipur, where the Manipur has built their houses quite substantially from mud and wattle. This was basically bamboo. A bamboo hut.
Was it surrounded by cultivated fields or anything of that sort?
By what?
Cultivation. Did they farm?
Yes, they had a sort of subsistence farming. I think they seemed to have a certain amount of pigs and poultry and stuff. It's pretty barren soil from that point of view. They just had they had little sort of vegetable patches. But my recollection is that they were a sort of. They had goats. I think they had the odd cow or two. A bit vague about that, frankly.
What sort of positions did you occupy on point 6052 and Wang?
Well, I went up there once. It was a dug-in, wired-in position with another outpost, a platoon outpost, at... I've got a map. I can get it. I think if I could just get it.
You were saying you had a dug-in, wired-in position.
That was on point 6052.
Yes.
And then...
This was a company position, wasn't
it? This was
it?
A company. And then they had a platoon outpost on a feature to the southeast, 7231, about a mile away.
When you say they were dug in, how deep were they dug? Were they in slit trenches or were they in something more substantial?
No, several slit trenches, but they did have wire, and that's good. I only went there once, so I'm a bit vague, but I mean, they'd taken some time. It wasn't just a sort of night place. I don't think they got any overhead cover or anything like that.
Were these generally one-man or two-man slit trenches?
Well, I think there were two men, always. Mm. Always. They weren't foxholes.
You said they were patrolling down towards the river and so on. When they went on a patrol, what sort of strength would they generate for that effort?
I think those days that the average recce patrol was about four men. See, way back in 42, we used to send out company patrols. Well, I mean, a company patrol is ludicrous. But I think the average recce patrol at this time, I think, was about 4 men. So that it gives you, if you see something of very tremendous interest, you've got 2 men can stay behind, continue to observe it. Well, a couple of chaps can take the information back. I think that was about it. It was considered to be about enough to cope with the situation, but not too big to be conspicuous, and enough to be able to give a bit of covering fire if you had to withdraw unexpectedly.
Could fall back by pairs, couldn't you?
Yes. Yeah. Also, of course, three men could carry a wounded man was just about.
Were they patrolling by night and day, or one or the other?
Well, I think we patrolled round the clock, yes. We certainly, this company, patrolled well down to the south. Trying to think of the name of the place. I can't think of it, but they certainly patrol well to the south. And we also, from battalion headquarters at Sizang, and the other company patrolled westward across the Manipur River.
Roughly, how much distance would they cover? If they were patrolling south, how far away would they go from their patrol base?
I think about two or three miles. They weren't... We did, I'm sure at one stage, I seem to remember now, we did send an officer patrol out on a chap called Bill Greenwood, went out on a 2 or 3 day patrol, well, some distance south. For what reason, I don't know. I think it was probably to contact the local, the headman down in that area. I think it was as much to show a British presence amongst the Chins, who were to some extent wavering.
Did you ever have occasion to use your jeeps for patrol purposes at this stage?
No, we used jeeps to run people down from Sizang down to the crossing just below Mul Bem, but A Company itself on 6052 was entirely supplied and looked on by mules. There was a tributary of the Bishanpur River. I think it's called the Stang Lui. And you couldn't get across that. And so it was all done on foot or by mule. I certainly, when I went up to 6052, I went up with the daily rations. Or ration party went up every day with ammunition and rations and mail and the else.
Battalion headquarters at Sizang. What did battalion headquarters consist of as deployed in the field?
We had a platoon, I think, a sort of defence platoon. It was just battalion headquarters. We had a section of 25 pounders under a British sergeant. We had a battalion mortars. And that was about it. It wasn't very large.
Was it dug in?
Oh, yes, dug and wired in. Oh, yes. Very much so. And we quite rightly took it. We had stand to morning and evening and all the rest of it. Oh, yes.
So full field routine.
A big one?
Full field routine.
Absolutely. Mm.
Where did you actually live? Did you have tented?
We just we just lived in dugouts. Town headquarters was in a deep dugout, covered over with timber and stuff. It was proof against shellfire or mortarfire. Because we were, on Christmas Day, the Japanese shelled us with 155 fires, which made us bloody angry.
So
the buggers, can't they leave us alone at Christmas? I don't know where they're, because 155 is quite a long range, so they were way out to the south of us.
155 would be able to reach, what, 20 miles, something like that, would it, that time?
I would have thought that was a bit high, but certainly 12, 15 miles. Anyway, 15. Anyway, they were way away to the south of us, anyway. But anyway, it was a proper soldierly position.
Was it camouflage as well as dug in and wired?
No. I mean, it was stuck out like a sore thumb. But then it was pretty open. I mean, it was only just scrub. So that... I think the guns had camouflage nets over them. It couldn't have failed to observe it as a position, I don't think.
What means of communication did you have? Forward to the companies and back to...
We had radio.
You had radio. Did that work?
Yes, it did, because when the company was heavily attacked, when the Japanese offensive started, they attacked 7231, and their platoon was withdrawn to 6052. And I was just shaving one morning when a signal rushed to me, the adjutant, and said, "Air company commander wants you urgently," and I rushed to the radio, and all I could hear was this chap, Clifford Martin, who's a long friend, he was just shouting, "London, London, London," which was the code word for the 25-pounders to fire. They were firing at 13,000 yards.
It's a long way for 25.
Well, you see, normal maximum range is 11,000. Because of the altitude, they could get another couple of thousand.
Did they have to use supercharge to get
the extra? I think so. I can see it now because everybody we'd stood to, and we just stood down. The British soldiers were all sitting there drinking cups of tea, and the sergeant was there, and I shouted, "London." Well, I think technically, guns couldn't open fire without a gunner officer giving the word. But he wasn't going to mess about. We had very good understanding, and he reckoned if the adjutant of the Baluchis shouted "London," he wasn't doing it just for a bloody joke. Anyway, I remember he dropped his mug of tea and flung himself at the cord. They had a cord then, and then the other one went off, and these two rounds sailed away, and it just caught the Japs coming in over the wire. It was as close as that. They were hacking, Clifford Martin said the Japs were hacking their way through the wire, and it caught them. That was a defensive fire task. I think they would fire automatically two or three more rounds each gun. So about eight rounds went away, and that just made the difference. If it hadn't been for that, I think the Japs would have overrun it, but it just caught them on the wire. Right? I mean, it was fortunate, the ideal moment. But we still talk about London because it has special significance. The gunners used to always bang on. They were rightly and proudly the fact that they had fired a successful defensive fire task at 13,000 yards.
It's an impressive achievement.
Yeah, it was, actually. I mean, it was brilliant bit of artillery support. And, of course, it had an enormous morale effect on our soldiers. And it built up a very good rapport between us, because our chaps came to rely on the efficiency and of the gunners a lot, actually.
How many DFs did they have registered on their maps when you were in this position?
On this particular one, or generally?
Generally, you know. Well, when you were at Sizang and you had the guns there with you, how many DFs did that section of guns have logged?
Well, I think they had other ones, but then the procedure was you had